Hi, welcome to Literary Italy. Follow us on Facebook at Literary Italy, at Instagram at Literary Italy Podcast, and on Twitter at Literary Italy. Our website address is www.literaryitaly.com. Our email address is mail@literaryitaly.com. We'd love to hear from you. Hi, Anne.
Hey, Jim. You sounded a little bit desperate there.
Desperate? Yeah, I am desperate. I'm a desperate man.
Please send us an email.
Please. Anywho, we are heading back down south to Pompeii.
To the Campania region.
We have been, one of the, our kind of really enjoyable trips was to Naples and to the Amalfi Coast. And in, as part of that trip, I guess this was in 2015, and keep me honest here.
Yeah,
we visited Vesuvius and Pompeii and Herculaneum. And so we thought we would take a look at an eyewitness account by from a letter from Pliny the Younger, discussing his uncle's unfortunate end in the eruption of Vesuvius.
Yeah, and it's really kind of a fascinating firsthand experience of what happened in 79 AD when Vesuvius blew its top, literally. Up until that point, the people in the vicinity didn't even realize it was a volcano. They just called it the mountain, you know. And if you've seen pictures of Vesuvius, you see this, well, it's such a classic volcano shape with it, with a deep cut in the top. Before that, it looked like a mountain. It looked like an everyday mountain. It's just that for centuries, it had been dormant. So it had been building up underground. And when it went with full force.
Mm-hmm.
It was a huge explosion. I was looking up how high. I think it was like 20 kilometers into the sky that the pumice flew up, and then of course began to rain down. So we have from these two letters from Pliny the Younger to Tacitus that describe his experience, and he was young. I mean, 18, 19 right. years old.
And before we go any further, before we just drop, Tacitus in his own right is a very famous Roman author who composes histories basically of what he sees as a decadence in Rome. But it's important that this is sort of a very well-documented and well-known set of exchanges that Pliny wrote to emperors and to historians and became a fairly well established, a real player both in history and also in the politics of his day.
Pliny the Younger.
Pliny the Younger and Pliny the Elder. Well, we'll talk about Pliny the Elder in a bit. And you look like you've lost something.
I'm looking for my copy.
Oh, sorry.
So he wrote these two letters, and the first describes what happened with his uncle, Pliny the Elder, who, when they saw, and again, this was August 24th, 79 AD, they were in the town of Misenum, which is Miseno. It's sort of, let's say, south. Well, I guess it's not south. It's kind of west on the western, you know, if you follow the coast past Naples, it's kind of west of mm-hmm. Naples. And his uncle, Pliny the Elder, was an admiral in the Roman Navy.
And
so he was stationed there.
And Pompeii is on, if I recall, is more on the eastern side of the bay of Naples.
Yes. So they looked across, and actually I think he says it's his mother. So he says, "My mother pointed out a cloud with an odd size and appearance that had just formed. From that distance, it was not clear from which mountain the cloud was rising, although it was found afterwards to be Vesuvius. The cloud could best be described as more like an umbrella pine than any other tree because it rose high up in a kind of trunk and then divided into branches." It's amazing because it sounds like an atomic bomb. But and in fact, it's like 20 times
it's also such
larger
a great
than Hiroshima.
Local, it's such a great local description because there are so many umbrella right? pines there.
Umbrella right. pines, right. It's something that the reader would understand
right.
where I think an American reader is like, what's an umbrella pine?
Yeah, it's basically a go dog, go tree.
So it is. So Pliny the Elder is an interesting character. And he is known for, you know, as I mentioned, that he was a high-ranking official in the Roman army, but he also is best known to us, I think, today as the author of this encyclopedia of these natural histories. So he sees this phenomenon and says, I got to see this.
You know? Nephew, do you want to come?
Nephew, do you want to come? He says, no, thank you. I have homework. Doesn't he say something like that?
He says, well, he says that he has studies, but in it actually turns out the if you look at the note, he actually says, and some of those things were things my uncle had assigned.
His uncle was his tutor. Yeah.
Right. Because his uncle was a great naturalist and philosopher.
Yeah. So his uncle really wanted, Pliny the Elder wanted to see this. So he takes off across the bay to see what's going on side of the bay where these mountains are, Mount Vesuvius, which has changed dramatically. So what happens is, I guess before the uncle leaves, he receives a message that Rectina, who is the wife of Toscus, who I guess is one of the generals in the army, is stranded there. So in addition to being sort of an observational trip, it's actually a rescue mission. So his uncle goes off and sets off to try to rescue this Roman noblewoman. And he gets there, one of the things is I think there's kind of a perception that Vesuvius erupts and everyone dies. And that's not the case. Right. Pompeii was a city of about 20,000 people at the time, plus there were other cities around, Herculaneum, we're going to talk about, Stabiae, and not everyone dies because a lot of people get out because they can see what's going on. I mean, that there's ash in the air, there are things falling from the sky, and it's time to get out. And she just can't leave. I mean, she's not able to leave the port. So this is from the letter of Pliny the Younger. And he writes, the ash already falling became hotter and thicker as the ships approached the coast, and it was soon superseded by pumice and blackened burnt stones shattered by the fire. Suddenly, the sea shallowed where the shore was obstructed and choked by debris from the mountain. He, that is Pliny the Elder, wondered whether to turn back, as the captain advised, but decided instead to go on. Fortune favors the brave, he said.
Yeah, I will never hear that quote quite the same way. I've always thought, oh, that's a really positive thing. It's like, yeah, that's what they told Pliny right before he died.
Yeah. So he, how do you see him as reckless, or do you see him as brave?
Oh, I see him as brave, but he died, right? Fortune did not favor the brave in this.
So what happens is Pliny does get there with servants and other assistants. And once there, they're kind of stuck.
Right.
Right. And during that night, you know, so a lot of the people who died as a consequence of the eruption of Vesuvius died not on August 24th, 79 AD, but August 25th, which is when there was really this pyroclastic flow of gases that kind of came through. And if you hadn't been killed by the pumice falling from the sky, you were killed by these gases or ultimately, you know, suffocated by the ash that was falling out of the sky. So Pliny the Younger includes...
But it's interesting because he actually describes Pliny the Elder, like their decision. So it sounds like, I'm assuming that not everyone in this town died because there's a story that is told of how they decide they're fearful because ash is falling on all around and they're trying to decide, do we stay indoors and be trapped or do we go outdoors and have something heavy fall on us? So they decide they're going to go outdoors and they basically wrap their heads in sheets and pillows to try to keep any debris from hitting them. And the Pliny the Younger recounts, it's interesting. He says, he himself stood up, then suddenly flames and a strong smell of sulfur, giving warning of yet more flames to come, forced the others to flee. And Pliny the Elder, he himself stood up with the support of two servants, and then he suddenly collapsed and died because, I imagine, he was suffocated when the dense fumes choked him. The other translation edition of this letter refers to his weak throat, and I kind of thought he has an underlying condition. He is what's the phrase now? He has comorbidity. He had a comorbidity, a weak throat. Yeah. But it appears that someone else recounted this, that he got this account from other people. So not everyone died. He was and the letter also does indicate that he was heavy, another comorbidity.
Yeah.
He was a big guy, Pliny the Elder.
Meanwhile, and this is the second letter, mm-hmm. Pliny the Younger is still in Misenum with his mother. After my uncle left us, I studied, dying.
And the mother is Pliny the Elder's sister.
Yes, who's mm-hmm. also heavy. I think he mentions that. And at a certain point, you know, they're feeling these tremors. I mean, there's earthquakes going on. And they say, you know, we've got to flee. And as they see, you know, buildings are falling down and people are starting to panic, and they decide that they need to leave the road mm-hmm. because the fear is that everyone's going to converge on the road and will be trampled. So they kind of get off more into the countryside, and they do move off into the countryside, and they flee, and they're able to survive. He says, this is in the second letter. He says, we could hear women shrieking, children crying, and men shouting. Some were calling for their parents, their children, or their wives, and trying to recognize them by their voices. Because at this point, the ash is coming down, and it's dark. It's completely black. Some people were so afraid of dying that they actually prayed for death. Many begged for the help of the gods, but even more imagined that there were no gods left, and that the last eternal night had fallen on the world. There were also those who added to our real perils by inventing fictitious dangers. Some claimed that part of Misenum had collapsed or another part was on fire. It was untrue, but they could always find somebody to believe them. Mm. So this is panic. I mean, right. It is really what he's describing. It's really a fascinating account. A glimmer of light returned, but we took this to be a warning of approaching fire rather than daylight. You know, they can't tell when is day and when is night. They don't have clocks. You know, they're waiting for the sunlight, but they can't tell what is day. The fire stayed some distance away. The darkness came back and ash began to fall again, this time in heavier showers. We had to get up from time to time to shake it off, or we would have been crushed and buried under its weight. I could boast that I never expressed any fear at this time, but I was only kept going by the consolation that the whole world was perishing with me. After a while, the darkness paled into smoke or cloud, and the real daylight returned. But the sun shone as wanly as during an eclipse. We were amazed by what we saw, because everything had changed and was buried deep in ash like snow. So this complete, you know, and if you look at a map, we should probably provide a map of that Bay of Naples. Misenum is on the opposite side of the Bay of Naples from Pompeii.
Pompeii, yes.
So it's quite a distance, 20 miles or so, but it's affected this entire area. It's really destroyed a whole lot.
But here, the thing that seems most terrifying is the fear. They survive, but there's ash, there's debris all around. And there's, as you pointed out, utter panic. It's interesting also, the edition that we listened to in the secondary, not the one we're reading from, we will link to a different one, Anne, that's more complete. But he also refers in the second letter to a friend of his uncle's from Spain who comes and says, "What are you guys doing here? Get up and get out. Your uncle is either alive, in which case he wants you to go, or if he's dead already, don't stick around trying to figure out what's going on with him. Save yourselves."
Yeah.
He really tries to bestir them. It's kind of interesting because the first part, like you mentioned, Dan, there's this kind of naturalist curiosity, like what is going on? We have to investigate.
It's a mountain. This is not, you know, if you live near an active volcano, as many people right now in Campania do, because they still live at the footsteps of Vesuvius. And something like this happened, you would know, oh, the volcano is erupting. They didn't know that it was a volcano. It had been dormant for centuries. I mean, not just for a couple of years, but for centuries. That said, there had been a couple of warning signs. There had been a couple of tremors in the previous couple of years. And so there were people that were that felt something was happening, whether they attributed it to the gods or to the natural world, they kind of knew Vesuvius is not a great place to be. This mm-hmm. is, you know, I'm going to move a little bit farther away. And they did. Once Pompeii is really destroyed, I mean, the city of Pompeii is destroyed, and some of the surrounding cities as well, Herculaneum and so on, they're kind of over the centuries forgotten. And they don't really come back into history until the excavations around the 16th, 17th century, where they start digging and they realize, you know, what is this that we're finding? You know, what is this Roman town? And they find not only, you know, is there this Roman town there, but it's remarkably well preserved.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a unique event. It's a unique opportunity to really see what life was like in 79 AD in a Roman city. In addition to Pompeii, you know, as we mentioned, there's also Herculaneum, which was a smaller town, but it was closer to the shoreline. It was, so you can imagine, it was sort of like the Hamptons for Pompeii. You know, it was a ritzier mm-hmm. area. You know, it was a smaller, ritzier. Also, was completely destroyed, but is better preserved than Pompeii. So that's another place that you can go and visit. We're going to link to Pliny's letters so people can read for themselves. But I thought today we'll talk a little bit about visiting Pompeii, Mount Vesuvius, and Herculaneum.
Sounds good.
Okay. So those are three very common destinations for people who are in the area in Campania, either going to Naples or perhaps to the Amalfi Coast. You could, in theory, go to Pompeii, Mount Vesuvius, and Herculaneum all in one day. It would be a long and exhausting day. And I think the only way you could do that is if you had a tour guide who was personally transporting you to each of those places. Not going to say it's impossible, but I'm also not going to say that it's a good idea. So I will say that what we did is we did one day of Mount Vesuvius and hiking up Mount Vesuvius and going to Herculaneum, and a separate day of going to Pompeii.
Mm-hmm.
And even though we devoted a whole day to Pompeii, because of getting there and getting back, that in itself was a really long and exhausting day. You know, do you remember?
Yeah, I do remember. I remember being on.
Yeah. So
it was a lot.
It was a lot. So you have kind of two options. I mean, you could visit Pompeii from Naples, and you can visit from probably the easiest way as far as public transportation, from Sorrento. And in either case, there's a rail line called the Circumvesuviana, and that goes from Naples and it ends up in Sorrento. So you can get off either in the Pompeii train station or the Herculaneum, Ercolano station. I think it's worthwhile. I mean, it's an easy trip. Sometimes that train kind of has a bad reputation for pickpockets and things. I didn't really notice it. I do remember the band of musicians coming on and singing, and I thought maybe they were trying to be distracting, but
they were just musicians.
They were just musicians looking for a tip.
You see that, you see that around. That's I think we've talked about this around the Naples area. Street musicians. It's one of the really beautiful things about that area of Campania.
Yeah, I think in general, as far as keeping your wits about you in that area, as you know, Naples, using public transportation. Perhaps because we've lived in New York City and we're used to that, you know, you go on the subway, you're always aware of where you're
right.
of where your well, I would wallet
say,
is.
Yeah, I would say be aware of it, but I would also tell you the same thing in Rome. Definitely be
sure.
aware.
And I would tell you the same thing in Florence. I know more people have been pickpocketed in Florence than any other city. And it may just be because there are so many Americans who go to Florence. But so I wouldn't discourage people from taking the Circumvesuviana rail. I think it's actually very convenient. It's old, you know, it's not like this high, like fancy train, but I think it's really kind of gives you a little authentic look at Naples through the back door. But that can take you to, let's start with Herculaneum. So it can take you to Ercolano is the station for Herculaneum. The site of Herculaneum is about a 10-minute walk from the train station. And it gets 10% of the numbers of people who go to Pompeii or even less. It is, as I said, it's a smaller site, but it's much better preserved and much better labeled. You can actually navigate Herculaneum on your own. I think we got, you know, an audio, like we rented one of those headphones, an audio guide, but it's not as overwhelming as Pompeii. So if you're considering seeing Pompeii, but you think, I don't really know that I want to spend the whole day, or maybe I'm not that interested in it, you may actually get a whole lot of, out of Herculaneum.
Yeah, but there's more pornography in Pompeii.
Well,
you want to see ancient pornography.
I think it's also worth mentioning, though, with Pompeii, there's so much that was in Pompeii that has been removed and is now in the Archaeological Museum in Naples, mm-hmm. the National Archaeological Museum in Naples, which I would say is not to be missed. It's one of the most important archaeological museums in Italy, if not the world. And yes, all the ancient porn that Jim is so interested in is there in Naples. You can also see in Pompeii, there is the brothel, you know, you can go mm-hmm. in where it's like, you know, like if you go in a McDonald's and they have, you want a Big Mac, you want a supersize.
Usually
that.
There's a, but there's like, a phallus above the door.
But
they're
various sex acts, you know, oh, I'll have the number four, whatever, supersize me. In addition, another great place to visit is Mount Vesuvius itself. I would say of the three things that we
saw, I loved
Pompeii, Herculaneum, and Mount Vesuvius, Mount Vesuvius was probably my favorite.
Vesuvius is a little intimidating, though. So a couple of things. The last time it erupted, now I don't remember the details on
1944?
This. 1944? In the fort, right.
But timing. Well, it's like, hey, there's a war.
But it was regularly erupting every seven or so years.
Yeah.
What happened the last time and the eruptions were mild, is that basically the center of it collapsed and sealed. So it hasn't erupted in, it's like 50 years, over 50 years, more like 60, 70 years overdue. And it used to erupt, that pressure used to get released every 7 years. So I kind of think when the old man wakes up, he's going to be a little bit angry.
Yeah. So the last time it erupted was March of 1944. The park of Vesuvius is fascinating. And like many of the natural parks in Italy, they have park rangers who are there to tell you what you're seeing. So it's fascinating because you see the smoke.
And you smell a little bit of sulfur. And they also detailed that all of the neighboring localities have evacuation plans.
Yes.
They have all planned for what's going to happen if this thing blows its top.
So there are about 2 million people now living in that range of Mount Vesuvius. And yes, they, you know, and the thing is, it's, you know, it takes your chances. The thing is that...
But, you know, it makes the soil so interesting.
I was going to say, there's trade-offs. The soil is incredibly fertile. It's great soil for planting. It's great soil for...
For grapes.
For grapes.
I think it's the Aglianico and the... What's the...
Lacrima Christi.
Lacrima Christi.
The wine from the area is delicious. So you takes your chances.
Literally the tears of Christ.
The tears of Christ. So... it's a very fertile soil around there, around the volcano. And they do have a system in place in the event that Vesuvius erupts again. They're obviously also, I think the park ranger said it is the most watched volcano in the world right now.
Right.
You know, so they're watching it all the time. And, you know, as I mentioned with that 79 AD eruption, there were inklings that things were going on. And there were people in Pompeii who were saying, you know, I think I'm going to transfer to, you know, request a transfer to Rome or get out of this vicinity.
Right.
That they just didn't feel comfortable being, that there were earthquakes and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, obviously, if things like that are going on. But I think, and I think we mentioned this in the previous episode, the entire peninsula is seismic. I mean, it's like living in California.
Yeah, I was about to say, if we've got listeners in California, you guys already know about this.
But they don't have volcanoes in California. I'm sorry.
What do we call it again? The flow? The
pyroclastic.
But yeah, there's no pyroclastic flow with the earthquake.
Yeah. So let's see. So I think, as I described, that when we were in this area, we saw Herculaneum and Vesuvius in one day, Pompeii in another. That to me was kind of a nice pace. You might try to see all three in one day. You might decide that you want to skip Herculaneum and only do Pompeii and Vesuvius or whatever. But I would suggest that you take your time because it's fascinating on an historical level, on the level of natural history. It's beautiful, you know, the scenery, the wildflowers, etc. There is also, by the way, a bar on the top of Mount Vesuvius.
Oh, right. Yes.
And so once you climbed, so you can get a bus from the train station at Ercolano that will take you up to the foot of Mount Vesuvius. You still have to walk up. This is not really a path for someone who has problems walking. I mean, so I would suggest that you have good footwear. Doesn't have to be hiking boots, but it should be something like sneakers that you don't mind getting dirty because there's still volcanic ash everywhere. Once you get up to the top, you can be rewarded by a bar that has coffee, also has wine, and maybe a little snack up there at the top if you haven't brought your snack with you.
I'm a young boomer dad, so I did my homage to Genesis and danced on a volcano.
Oh, I don't even know the reference. I just remember Genesis you saying that you had a bucket list and you had one thing on your bucket list,
dance which on a volcano.
Was to drink a glass of wine at the top of an active volcano. And you did it.
Yes, but I actually added that to my bucket list about 5 minutes before I did it.
Oh, all right.
I saw the wine. I was like, oh, add that to the bucket list and then do it. That's the way you want to do it. Always write your goals right after you've achieved them.
You know, in addition, things to look around for. In Pompeii, you'll see these cats and dogs that live in the ruins, particularly the dogs. Do you remember that they were, that they're just known and people feed them scraps and they live there in the ruins and also the cats. In addition to Pliny's letters, there's a number of movies, a number of books that take place in Pompeii, you know, the last days of Pompeii. Robert Harris has a book called Pompeii. There's a BBC documentary. Mary Beard has a book, The Pompeii, The Life of a Roman Town. It really is a town and an event that I think has captured people's imagination. It's just fascinating to me that it was buried for so long. Like, I think we think of Pompeii as, you know, it was buried and then people knew about it, but really people kind of moved on. And so it didn't come back until the excavations of the 16th and 17th centuries. And even then, you know, even now they're finding out more and more. You know, they've uncovered like a fast food restaurant in Pompeii where with the various signs for the things to eat. There's so much there. I will say that the site of Pompeii is huge. That's one place where I regret not having gotten an official tour guide. I would suggest that you get an official tour guide, not just someone who's there at the gate saying, hey, I can give you a tour. But I would wait until you get your tickets and then get in there and get an official tour guide for Pompeii if you are going to spend the entire day there.
Yep.
If you go to Herculaneum, I do think that's kind of navigable on your own. You could do, you know, audio guide or like a map or something like that. Herculaneum is fascinating because, as I said, it was a seaside town, and basically that town was destroyed the day after the eruption, and the people were trapped there because they were waiting for boats to get out of there. So there's a whole bunch of preserved skeletons just there at the shoreline. And I think that really kind of hits you. I think those plaster casts that the plaster casts in Pompeii and Herculaneum, the skeletons. So in Pompeii, there were people who were trapped and they were really suffocated by the falling ash and also by the gases. And over the years, this ash kind of formed there were these hollows inside. And so in the excavations, they found these hollows and they didn't exactly know what was inside. They filled them with plaster. And when they broke them apart, they found they were people, you know, people that where they had laid dying in some cases, you know, embraced adults with children. I mean, things that are really dogs.
Yes.
Do you remember?
Yeah, there's a dog that's in horrible.
There's a dog that appears to be trying to chew at its chain. And I think that hit our kids more than the people, you know, that this thing like, oh.
Well, it looks like it's writhing. Yeah, it's a horrible.
So there's this sense of really capturing, you know.
A moment.
The moment of the disaster. Yeah. And it's really quite fascinating.
Yep. Let's talk about food. I kind of
okay, let's talk about food. I thought we talked about Lacrima Christi, the Tears of Christ wine.
There's also the Aglianico, which is very popular, the reds, the Taurasi reds. And I was also thinking, well, if you're, you know, you'll be in pizza. You know, we talked in our Rome episodes, we talked about pizza al taglio, you know, by the slice. But this is much, to me, this Naples pizza is just in a class.
You know, and when
class.
People ask me if, you know, for a recommendation for a place to eat someplace in Italy other than Naples, I'll usually suggest find a pizzeria run by a Neapolitan, whether it's in Florence or Padua, that's going to be the best pizza you're going to get.
The other thing would be like a dish like spaghetti with clams and have that. There are an awful lot of very nice white wines. So the Falanghina that we would drink there, Anna, if you remember, or the Greco di Tufo. Those are two really nice white wines that are local to the area and pair very well with seafood.
You know, that said, that actual area of Pompeii, Herculaneum, Mount Vesuvius is not so much a place I would say that you would stay in. You could. I mean, I think there are a couple of Airbnbs and certainly there are some hotels, but I think you're better off staying either in Naples and taking the train or taking a car service or Sorrento and taking the train from the other direction.
Here's a quick quiz for you, Anne.
Okay.
What writer is credited with having popularized the Falanghina wine?
What writer?
Yes.
John Steinbeck.
Pliny the Elder. Right around.
John Steinbeck we'll talk about when we talk about Positano.
Positano, yes.
So Pompeii, Herculaneum, Vesuvius, all absolutely. Oh, and I should mention, because I'm talking about Naples and Sorrento as being your home base. Some people do visit Pompeii from Rome, and that's definitely doable. It's a very long day trip, and I would recommend that you have a guide, like do a packaged tour from Rome. Mm. But you can do it in one day. I wouldn't recommend doing Pompeii, Herculaneum, and Vesuvius all in one day. If you're going to do that, definitely stay overnight. First of all, because Naples is just an amazing city and deserves more than one night, deserves many, many nights. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to wander down to the Amalfi Coast, that's also Pompeii is also accessible from there as well. But fascinating, you know,
yes.
On so many different levels, as I said, from a scientific level, historical level. Here we have a little bit of the literature as well. I think it's really captivated the imagination. And I know we traveled there with our kids and they were fascinated by it.
Yeah.
You know, that they really appreciated that this was a special place, that this was, you know, and I think that when you see these casts and you see the skeletons or whatever, there's a sense of, you know, that they were like us.
Yeah.
You know, and it's that at that moment, you know, you know neither the time or the day, and they were there at the wrong time and the wrong day. So August 24th, 79 AD.
Yeah. Bad hair day.
That was very bad.
Very bad. All right. I think that's a good place for us to say so long. So this has been another episode of Literary Italy. Thanks for joining us. And until next time. Well, we'll see you soon. Yeah, we usually say till next time. That's all we say.
Okay,
alla prossima.
Ciao. Ciao.